Hi, I'm Dr. Nancy Smith at the University at Buffalo School of Social Work, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the concept of trauma-informed practice, and ideally this supplements a blog post that I wrote for International Social Work Week. I'll talk briefly about the idea of trauma and its definition and its impact, and then get into some of the key principles for trauma-informed practice. Then I'll spend a little bit of time talking about one particular principle in depth, just to give an idea about how many layers these principles can have. To start, to briefly talk about the definition of trauma, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that's used in the United States, the DSM-IV, talks about trauma as an event involving actual or threatened death or serious injury, or a threat to physical integrity of self or others. And the idea is that you can experience this yourself or witness it. But Donald Meichenbaum's given a definition that's a little more consumable, less scientific perhaps, but a little more understandable. And he talks about events that are so extreme, severe, and powerful, harmful or threatening, that they can require extraordinary coping efforts. And again, the idea is that we can experience these directly or we can witness them in people around us. And then finally, McCann and Perlman have talked a little bit about how psychological trauma can be either sudden and unexpected or non-normative, something that doesn't fit with the experience that we should have at this particular point in life, and that it exceeds an individual's perceived ability to meet its demands, so this is a sense that we can't cope with it, and that it can disrupt an individual's frame of reference as well as the psychological needs at the time. Some of the consequences of trauma, you can get an increase in things like the fight-or-flight response, which is that adrenaline response that we get when threatened, or an increased freeze response. And that's a response you see often in nature, where animals will freeze when they're threatened. This happens in people as well. Hypervigilance, an extreme sense of having to scan the environment for a threat, arousal, paranoia. You can get more perceptual and information processing distortions, so intrusive images or thoughts, even hallucinations. Higher levels of pain tolerance, emotional blunting, and that's sort of a numbing, as well as feelings of aggression and irritability. Hi, this is Dr. Nancy Smith, and I'm at the University at Buffalo School of Social Work. I'm going to be talking a little bit about the concept of trauma-informed practice, and this supplements a blog post that I wrote also for International Social Work Week. I'll start talking a little bit just about trauma, and then the concept of trauma-informed practice, or as it's also called, trauma-informed care. And then I'll just go into depth a little bit about one of the principles of trauma-informed practice. When I talk about trauma, the diagnostic manual, DSM-IV, that's currently used in the United States, discusses trauma as an event that involves actual or threatened death or serious injury or a threat to the physical integrity of self and others. So you can experience trauma or you can witness it. But others have written about trauma in ways that maybe make a little more common sense, although they may not be so scientific. Donald Meichenbaum talks about events that are so extreme, severe, powerful, or harmful, or threatening, that they require extraordinary coping efforts. And again, the idea is that we can experience these or witness them. And then McCann and Perlman talk about psychological trauma, that what's important about it is it can be sudden, unexpected, or non-normative, meaning it's not something that you would expect at this point in someone's life. It exceeds an individual's perceived ability to meet its demands or to cope with it, and it disrupts something about a personal's frame of reference and the psychological needs that somebody may have. So some of the consequences of trauma, we see increased reactions in terms of fight and flight and a freeze response. Fight and flight are those adrenaline reactions that we're used to seeing. Freeze is that sort of deer in a headlights, sort of stunned sort of state. And you can see that in nature a lot. You see animals freeze in reaction to threat. That's also something that happens to human beings. You also can get a much increased sense of hypervigilance, which is scanning and looking around the environment a great deal for threat, high arousal, some paranoia, and then quite a few perceptual and information processing distortions that can happen a lot more as a result of trauma. Things like intrusive images, intrusive thoughts, illusions where you see something out of the corner of your eye and it looks to you like something that was the trauma, and then you realize maybe it's just a shadow. But even hallucinations can be a consequence of trauma. You can see high pain tolerance and high levels of emotional blunting, sort of a numbing to emotions, as well as high levels of aggression and irritability. And then you can get some things that are decreased as a result of trauma. We certainly see more difficulty that people have with memory processing and retrieving memories, a decreased sense of what's real and not real, or what is technically called reality testing, a decreased sense of being aware of one's body and emotions. That's sort of the same as that emotional numbing I talked about. And a decreased immune response, which actually then can result in a whole series of vulnerability to physical illnesses. Now, sometimes when we talk about trauma reactions, you'll hear people distinguish between two major categories of trauma reactions, type 1 and type 2. Type 1 reactions are short-term unexpected events. They literally come out of the blue, very unexpected. Natural disasters can fall in this category, a severe car accident, a one-time rape. These are things that are likely to result in what we typically think of as post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms. And this is probably what people typically think of when they think of as trauma that goes with PTSD. The other type of trauma reaction, type 2, is also sometimes called complex trauma or complex PTSD. And these are more sustained, repeated stressors, sometimes called ordeal stressors. So now, it's not that something comes out of the blue. There's a sense that something bad is going to happen. It's just a question about when. Examples of this are ongoing physical or sexual abuse, ongoing severe combat situations. What we know about these complex trauma sorts of events and the complex trauma reactions is you're much more likely in this case to see long-standing characterological and interpersonal problems, things that look like they're part of the personality, significant levels of dissociation, which is disconnecting from your experience, and substance abuse. And so these complex trauma reactions may not look at all like PTSD, and yet we're coming to understand that they, too, are really a consequence of trauma. A psychologist by the name of Ricky Greenwald sometimes talks to his clients about the idea of the wall, the trauma wall, and it's really just a metaphor to help people understand what happens when you live through things that are very overwhelming. Generally, when we have experiences in life, we digest them emotionally. We sort of take in the emotions, we feel them, and then our brain and body digest those experiences and integrate them into our long-term experience, long-term memory. But for whatever reason, sometimes very upsetting experiences don't seem to get emotionally processed. They really sort of sit undigested in our mind and body. Maybe it's just too much to face. It may have something to do with our biology. But for whatever reason, the events can stay stuck in memory and fresh as though we were still feeling them at the time that they were experienced. In this case, many people try to push these unsettling memories behind a wall, sort of push them away as though they didn't happen. Now, he uses that phrase push, but in my experience, it's not as much of a deliberate conscious thing that someone does. It's just sort of an automatic survival. Push it out of mind and sort of focus on what you need to focus on. But the end result of this metaphorical wall is that the memory stays fresh and keeps its power. It doesn't become digested. And it stays behind this wall, but not entirely, so that you can get some leakage of the memories. They can leak out when something in the environment is triggering, activates that memory. And that means a trigger is usually something that's thematically related or related in terms of something about the way my senses are experiencing the memory, start to bring it back. And so, say for a combat veteran who's walking down the street, a car backfires, and that is similar enough to the sound of a gun that it triggers a reactivation of a combat memory. Over time, these memories can become stockpiled behind the wall, and Greenwald describes them as becoming sore spots for us, spots that are more sensitive and likely to evoke strong emotional reactions. And so really, this is just a way of then understanding our clients' behaviors. Most of the behaviors that we label as problems that people come to us for help are really, from a trauma-informed perspective, most of these are reactions to sore spots being triggered or skills that they develop to deal with the sore spots or with the traumatic event. Examples of this might be kids who have extreme anger toward authority figures, and when you explore the trauma history, you find they were in fact hurt by people in authority positions. Parents, of course, are our most typical authority figures, but they're not the only ones. You get someone who doesn't speak up to their doctor and yet then doesn't follow through on the doctor's orders, what's sometimes called passive-aggressive behavior. And yet for someone who grew up in a family where speaking up was physically punished, where you were physically abused, it would make perfect sense that you wouldn't speak up to someone in authority figure. So this lens of understanding trauma as a cause of many of the client behaviors that we might see in people we're working with trauma histories, a trauma-informed perspective helps us understand that it's not just post-traumatic stress disorder that we're going to see as consequences of this in people's lives. It's day-to-day behaviors. I think what's most important to understand about trauma, though, is that the process of going through a traumatic experience, it creates a powerlessness and a sense of vulnerability. And that's true no matter what the type of trauma, whether it's growing up in a family where you're being abused, or whether you're going through a natural disaster or through a war. Therefore, as part of a recovery process, people need to take some power back over their lives. And what's important to understand about this is that can't happen if they're in a program or a helping relationship that isn't empowering. If the program or relationship is one that is very authority-centered, it's going to be one that will come too close to replicating the state of powerlessness that I was in at the time of the trauma. So one of the things that I use in Signals when I work with clients is that when I get into a power struggle with a client, I need to step back and examine what's going on, because something about choices that I've made has triggered that sense of powerlessness and vulnerability and means that I really need to step back and figure it out and make some different choices so that my client doesn't feel so threatened. So then the whole process of understanding things from a trauma-informed practice lens asks the significant question, instead of saying, what's wrong with this person? Which is really what you would ask if you're coming from a medical model. In other words, you'd say, what's the disease that this person has? What's the disorder? Instead of asking that, a trauma-informed model asks, what has happened to this person that helps to explain what's going on now? Part of understanding the differences in those questions is understanding that we have whole systems of care in developed nations, and I would say also in developing nations, that may destroy a sense of sanctuary and safeness that clients need in order to recover and get well. The concept of systems destroying sanctuary is one that is starting to get a lot of attention, at least in the United States. And one of the things that survivors of trauma are telling us are that these systems often give them messages about who they are that are very similar to what they heard in the families they grew up in. So, for example, a client might tell someone about experiences in a hospital, and in fact, I had a client who's given me permission to share this, about hospitalization. She had psychiatric hospitalization where the people, staff in the hospital told her and her family that her prognosis was very poor and she wasn't likely to get much better, that this was the state she sort of had to accept. Well, it was very hard not to hear that as you're defective and a hopeless case, which is pretty much how she had felt since childhood, and is not at all surprising that somebody would then feel suicidal. Similarly, systems that really disregard the valid needs and requests of patients give a message that you don't matter, and an overemphasis on compliance with treatment versus collaborating with people emphasizes the idea you're powerless. So these are all messages that our systems can inadvertently give people, and can actually, from a client's perspective, make things worse, reconfirm the very things that they've been struggling with as a result of the traumatic experiences that they live through. Another important idea about this idea of looking at systems of care and how sanctuary can destroy the healing properties of a system or an organization extends our perspective to look at. You can also get some things that decrease as a result of trauma. One is that we see a decrease in people's ability to process memories and retrieve them, a decrease in their sense of being able to tell what's real and what's not real, what's sometimes technically called reality testing, a decreased sense of one's body and emotional awareness, and a decreased immune response, which then increases vulnerability to getting physical illnesses. And when people talk about trauma reactions, they sometimes talk about two different types, type 1 and type 2. Type 1 trauma reactions are when unexpected events come out of the blue. These are things like natural disaster, a singular bombing attack, one-time rape, serious car accident. These are things that are likely to result in typical post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms. Type 2 trauma, on the other hand, it's not a question about whether something bad is going to happen. It's more a question of when it's going to happen. These are sustained, repeated stressors that people are experiencing. And the trauma reaction, sometimes this is called complex trauma, the trauma reaction is one that is more likely to result in symptoms that look like long-standing characterological and interpersonal problems, dissociation, and substance abuse. Examples of this would be ongoing physical and sexual abuse, ongoing significant combat exposure. These are the types of things, physical torture that's ongoing. All of these are more likely to result in these complex trauma reactions and not as often in something that looks just like post-traumatic stress disorder. In talking to clients about how trauma affects them, it's sometimes helpful to use metaphors. Dr. Ricky Greenwald, a psychologist, sometimes uses the metaphor the wall, and I found this to be a helpful one to use with clients as well. The idea of the wall is that sometimes upsetting experiences that we have just don't get processed by our mind and body. It's just too much for us to face. Maybe it was too upsetting an event, or we just don't have the ability to cope with it at the age that we're at when it's happening. And so what happens is that we start to just mentally, emotionally push the unsettling experience behind the wall, sort of pushing it away. Now, he uses the idea of pushing, but in my experience, it's not a conscious process. It's just something that automatically happens, partly to protect us. And really, what it is a temporary solution of pushing the experience out of awareness so that we can focus on getting on with life. The problem with this wall is that the memory stays fresh behind the wall. It keeps its power as though it had just happened. Generally, when things happen to us, we emotionally digest them and over time integrate them into our experiences. But things that are sort of stuck behind this wall do not. And so these things can just live there, and then something in the environment can trigger or activate something related to that memory, because it's related by theme or in terms of senses, and some of that memory leaks out, whether that be through intrusive thoughts or flooded by emotion. Other signals that they're at walls that we're stuffing things behind are when we have conflicts between cognition and emotion, or the head and heart. Over time, these memories become stockpiled behind these walls, and they become sore spots. And these sore spots then become vulnerable points for us in our lives. So this idea helps to understand some of the client behaviors that we see in the clients that come to us for help. Many of these behaviors, we've called them problems, are actually reactions to sore spots that have been triggered, or they might be skills that people develop to deal with the trauma that happened. An example of this might be a child who has extreme anger toward authority figures. And that might look very irrational until you go and look in the past and see, in fact, there had been significant trauma at the hands of authority figures, maybe in one case parents or other types of authority figures. Similarly, you might have someone who doesn't speak up to their doctor even though they disagree with something, and then they don't follow doctor's orders. This is a behavior we sometimes call passive-aggressive. And yet, this behavior may make a great deal of sense when you start to look at some of the old experiences the person had where speaking up to authority figures was punished and maybe resulted in physical abuse. The idea that these experiences sit back there behind walls until we're at a point where we can emotionally reprocess them is a helpful metaphor because it does help clients see the need ultimately to do work on some of those old memories. That kind of therapy work we would call trauma-specific work on the actual traumatic memories. Now, I find, in addition to this idea about understanding how memories can accumulate, what's probably most helpful for me to understand in working with people who've lived through trauma is that living through a traumatic event creates states of powerlessness and vulnerability. And that's true no matter what the event, whether it's a car accident, whether it's a natural disaster, or physical or sexual abuse. The lack of power is really a common denomination. So people really need to take power back over their lives as part of the healing process. And the problem is this can't happen in a program or in a helping relationship that isn't empowering in some way. So if a program or helping relationship is too authority-centered, it's going to replicate some of the powerlessness that someone experienced in the trauma. So when I get into a power struggle with a client, it's a signal for me to step back and examine what's going on, what I've done that's triggered some sense of powerlessness in the client, and what needs to change in my behavior to do that. This trauma-informed approach, in essence, starts asking different questions. The traditional medical model would ask, what's wrong with this person, meaning, what's the disorder or disease that we need to treat? The trauma-informed model recognizes that much of what we see is a result of what's happened, and so instead of saying what's wrong with this person, we ask what has happened to this person. This understanding of people and of what they've gone through is really the central thing in trauma-informed practice. Whatever the work we're doing with clients, it doesn't matter. We may not be specifically treating their trauma, but with this perspective, the way in which we go about working with them on any problem will change. So the core of trauma-informed practice is that all of the staff, from social workers to receptionists to janitors to executive directors, would be informed about and sensitive to trauma-related issues that are present in survivors and in communities of survivors. And then that we know also how to get people access to trauma-specific treatments when that time is appropriate. Trauma-informed practice, then, or trauma-informed care, as it's called a lot in the United States, provides services which allow clients to feel safe, accepted, understood by everyone who may come in contact with the client. Now, those are not new concepts, certainly not to social work. What's new is to involve our knowledge of trauma and trauma reactions in forming our services and approaches to clients, which allow an additional level of safety, of people feeling accepted and understood. So there are multiple models of trauma-informed care or trauma-informed practice. I'm going to talk about one that talks about five key principles, and these principles are evident in all models, but they may be divided up differently. Five principles are safety, trustworthiness, choice, collaboration, and empowerment. Again, that's safety, trustworthiness, choice, collaboration, and empowerment. So by safety, I'm talking really about concrete safety, This includes things like where services are offered, time of day that they're offered, whether there are security personnel available if something's being offered in a more unsafe place, open doors or locked, and the effect that each of these has on the recipients for service. Some people may feel less safe when a door is locked, by the way, because they feel trapped. So it's not as simple as what we might think it is. How does the waiting room look? Are all staff members attentive to signs of consumer discomfort? And are all staff members recognize these signs, understanding trauma reactions and what might be triggered for somebody? In terms of trustworthiness, this includes providing clear information about what will be done, by whom, when, why, and under what circumstances. Providing a lot of information to somebody, but in a way that they can consume it, about what to expect. It includes respectful and professional boundaries and tries as much as possible to avoid unnecessary consumer disappointment, letting people down, and really takes the concept of informed consent seriously and consistently. So it's not just having you fill out a form. It's really talking to people about what's in the form and making sure that they understand them and understand their choices. Choice, the next principle. This focuses on how much choice consumers have over the services they receive. And this includes anything from time of day to gender preferences for service providers. It really can help providing clear and appropriate messages to consumers about their rights and responsibilities, so that they understand where they do have choices and what sorts of choices are open to them. Collaboration is the fourth principle, and this involves giving consumers a significant role in planning and evaluating services. Consumer preference is given in areas of service planning and goal setting, as well as developing treatment priorities. So it's not simply sitting down and showing someone the service plan that I've developed for them and asking them to sign, which is a rather typical practice in many agencies, but instead actually developing a plan together based upon my input, my ideas about what I need to work on and what's going on in my life, and the two of us together working on that. It's really cultivating an atmosphere of doing with someone rather doing to or for somebody. And it's really conveying the message that the consumer is the expert in their own life. And then finally, empowerment includes recognizing someone's strengths and skills, building a realistic sense of hope for the person's future, providing an atmosphere that allows people to feel validated and affirmed with each and every contact at the agency. Now, these are fairly global principles that you can hear operating at an agency level, but I'm going to take one of them, trustworthiness, and just talk a little bit about how that can work within the helping relationship. Because there are a lot of layers to these principles. Certainly they relate to agency policies and procedures, but they also relate to what an individual social worker would do with a particular client. Trustworthiness is a great principle, I find, because, again, when you go back to trauma, it involves this sense of powerlessness. And if trauma is interpersonal trauma, meaning it's trauma that was caused by a human being, then issues of trust for human beings are going to be significant in someone's treatment. Now, for many of the clients that you come in contact with in social agencies, many of them have lived through significant trauma in childhood physical or sexual abuse, or emotional abuse. And that those are often things that they've experienced at the hand of caregivers who were supposed to be trustworthy. So the problem with treatment, of course, is that here I am, a caregiver, who is supposed to be in a trusted position. And just the roles alone set up a replication of the experience where somebody was hurt in the past. And so it's really not very surprising that clients would feel uncomfortable in treatment and recognizing that someone's new, that they don't know me, recognizing that, in fact, they have no reason to trust me. In other words, giving permission not to trust me is a great place to start with people who have been hurt. What I'll often say to people is that you don't know me. The fact that I'm sitting here in this job doesn't mean that you can trust me. You really are going to need to learn that for yourself. And so your permission to not trust and to test trust in our relationship. And in fact, we might have a conversation about how people do that. I mean, certainly I will describe the ways and the rules that I'm supposed to be observing, but I'll also acknowledge that they may have had experiences with people who didn't follow the rules and that there were consequences to them for that. I will encourage my clients to evaluate my behavior in terms of whether or not I'm trustworthy. Now, of course, I am not perfect, and I will make mistakes, and this is inevitable whenever you work with people. So the goal here isn't for us to be perfect people, but it is to be transparent. So if in the course of working with someone I give confusing messages or I make mistakes, what's most important when you're using trustworthiness as this core principle is to be genuine, to acknowledge that in fact I made a mistake and apologize for it. This experience by itself can be incredibly healing for people because they may not have had people and authority figures ever do anything like that. Part of transparency is not just about specific behaviors, but also about the process of how therapy works and the process of how we're going to put our sessions together. I think it's very helpful for clients to have structure in sessions, but it's especially helpful if it's a structure we can develop together. Otherwise, the power imbalance is such that I'm the one who develops the rules and enforces them, and the client doesn't get a say in that matter. So this is a good conversation we'll have together, and it's not one that we will have only once, because we may well develop a structure to how we're going to work together, and then a client comes in and decides that they want to do something differently, maybe because there's a different issue on their minds. And that's a great time to have a conversation about, well, do we want to not follow the structure together, and what are the consequences of that? And we can try that out and then evaluate it and then decide whether that's something we want to continue doing. The idea of respecting boundaries in relationships becomes particularly important. I think the most important boundary I start with trauma survivors, and really with all my clients, because I assume most of them have trauma histories, are that it's okay to say, I don't want to talk about something. I might even ask people to practice it with me, just saying that I know it can be hard, and sort of bear with me a little bit while we just practice, can you actually say that? And I will distinguish between saying, I don't want to talk about it, and I don't know. Because many times people will respond with an I don't know. Sometimes an I don't know is a placeholder for I don't want to talk about it. Other times, and I don't know is really simply an I don't know and has to do with that numbing reaction people get or dissociation. So making this distinction and making it okay to not talk about something really can help to determine what else is going on, because sometimes it's that people really are just confused about what they're experiencing. Being able to set up those boundaries and to respect them becomes important and may take a lot of practice before someone's comfortable doing it. Other types of boundaries that I really only come to think about more recently in the last few years are time boundaries. We have a session length, and I have to admit that I'm somebody that used to run over quite a bit in my sessions and then start running behind. And as I started to think about trustworthiness and to think about things from my client's perspective, what I realized is that the decision to extend a session was one that I was making without consulting them, and that would really start to feel a little unsafe. That extending a session might be a decision that we should make together, but the key is that we should make it together, and it shouldn't be an arbitrary decision of mine. And so ending on time also really seemed like it was a good idea that I should start to try to respect and to do more often and to see this as a boundary issue. And so boundaries can take a lot of forms, and obviously time is one of them, and boundaries between people and sessions, and then boundaries between sessions. So being able to be clear with people about my availability, what it was and what it wasn't. And if there are limitations on that, those limitations can be my limitations. I don't have to be perfect and ever-present, but that doesn't mean that the client's needs aren't important. And so if a client is needing me to be more present more frequently than I can, the problem isn't the client's neediness. The problem is that I'm not able to provide a high enough level of care for them, and that together let's figure out a way to supplement so that their needs are met. Another issue where trust comes in a great deal with people who've lived through trauma is helping them develop trust that I have some knowledge and skill that will be helpful to them. I find that many of my clients have had experiences of feeling significantly worse after their sessions with therapists, talking about a memory, for instance, or an upsetting incident. And since problems regulating feelings are often something that go with trauma, it's not uncommon for people to have a problem getting themselves grounded after a session, and yet they may not have ever said anything to a therapist about it. So I usually ask people about, you know, what post-session time has been like for them in the past, and I ask them about it, our work together. And together we need to make a goal that when they leave sessions, they're leaving sessions in a put-together state, that they're not leaving feeling worse than when they came in, and that there may be ways we have to structure our session or skills that we need to work on to make that, in fact, a goal that's achievable. And in this case, I'm really showing that I care about how they're going to be outside of sessions and I care about safety, but that I also can be trusted to provide them with some of the things that they need within our sessions and outside to help them become more stable. The last thing I'd like to note about trustworthiness relates to the therapeutic quality that goes with a good helping relationship, and that's genuineness. Really, the sense that people are there with a genuine person at the other end, not, as I sometimes will joke and say, Sally social worker or Thelma therapist. People want to know that there's a real human being there, and that obviously shouldn't be me talking about all my problems to them, because then I violated some boundaries. Because this relationship is about their needs. But it also, I do need to be genuine about emotional reactions I may be having to stuff that they're bringing up. If I'm getting frustrated with something, I need to be able to acknowledge that, and I need to be able to do it in a way that owns my feelings and can allow us to work that through. But pretending I'm not frustrated when I am is ingenuine, and in fact, clients will see through it because they've been in so many environments where their survival depended on knowing what people around them were thinking and feeling, or at least feeling, that they are hypervigilant to every little signal that you'll be giving. And so it's much better to acknowledge something like, you know, I'm sorry, I'm just distracted because I'm tired and didn't sleep as well. So let's talk about how I can work harder this session to make things focusing on your needs. But you know, your needs are important, and I do recognize that I may not be at the top of my game today. So those are just a few examples of how a principle like trustworthiness starts to translate down to a more of a clinical, practice level, from the agency level. And every one of the other five principles has their components as well. Quick example of safety, and then I'll move to just do some closing. And again, I'm going to share an example that a former client gave me permission to share. Some people have been abused where there are certain cues around them. Candles, incense, or I've had some clients have talked about being hurt with electrical devices. And so things that you have sitting out in your office may in fact be triggers and make people feel unsafe. Once you discover what they are, and that can take some time, it really then means going out of your way to make sure that I'm making this office a safe place for someone to come into. And I need to think about that. So it does require a level of mindfulness for me, moving from one session to the next with my clients, and changing things if I need to, so that the office is a place that feels like a safe place to someone. That level of awareness, and in fact even asking people, is there anything in this room which makes you feel uncomfortable? Those can be very helpful questions to show that you're attentive to safety and aware about how trauma reactions can come up for people. So if we had time, we could go into every one of those principles and get into much more specific examples of how they might translate into clinical practice. I hope I've given you a little bit of an idea about how that can happen. Every concept has system elements and practice behavior elements. And in the best systems, we'll have practitioners who are integrating this work into everything that they do, and receptionists will be integrating it into whatever their practice behaviors are. If these concepts are at all intriguing to you, I encourage you to explore them some more in a bit more depth. The blog post that I wrote includes some resources that you can look into. The continuing education department that we have at the University at Buffalo School of Social Work offers some online workshops on these topics. But you also can just get online and try searching on trauma-informed care, trauma-informed practice, and see what comes up. More and more, there are policy efforts that are happening, not just in the United States, but around the world. And people are creating a wealth of really wonderful resources on this topic. Thanks for your attention, and happy International Social Work Week.